With us today, we have a Nigerian human rights and labor activist, Mr. Segun Adeyemi. He'll be speaking about the stranglehold of multinational corporations and the IMF and the political and economic situation in Africa, and also the struggles of workers and youth to oppose these neoliberal policies and the poverty and the government repression. Mr. Adeyemi played a leading role in organizing resistance to the military dictatorship in Africa that ruled Nigeria from 1983 to 1999. He's the chairperson of the Lagos State chapter of the National Conscious Party, which is the main opposition party in Nigeria. It has a membership of 500,000 people. And he was a leading activist in Nigeria's anti-war movement against the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. So that's all I have right now, and so I'll let Segun speak.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm very delighted to have this opportunity to speak on this topic, the struggle against poverty and neocolonialism in Africa. And I'd like to express my special thanks to the Socialist Alternative, our sister organization, for making this occasion possible. To those that have been following events in the press, Nigeria has been in the news of recent, but as usual, for the wrong reasons or for the negative, events. The particular issue I'm referring to is around the sentences that have been passed by some Sharia courts on single women that have been sentenced to death, ostensibly for having children outside wedlock. This is the only time, or these are the type of occasions that you get the Western media, to feature Nigeria or any neocolonial country for that matter. And that is why I found it very remarkable, that the Socialist Alternative has put up this kind of program. As a matter of fact, today's program is part of a national meetings which have been holding, in a number of campuses. And the planning of this meeting started as early as February this year. And the topic, as I've said, is the struggle against poverty and neocolonialism in Africa. The advantage of this kind of foresight is that the comrades did not wait until a particular event occurs before they begin to feature on Nigeria and Africa. And I think this is the kind of positive approach we need if we are really interested in tackling the problem of Africa, and the world as a whole. Before I go on, I just like to say that two positive things I have encountered since I came to this country. I've been repeating this, at every meeting I've had cause to speak, but I think I can't be tired. The two are this. One, I've met, a kind of pleasant, unexpected warmth and openness among the ordinary American workers and youth. This is something special for us, particularly if you come from the third world countries, Nigeria. The usual comportment of Americans that we see over there, are the, arrogant, insensitive type, those that comport themselves as if they own the world and nobody else matters. These are the things, the kind of comportment you find among, global capitalist corporations, officials of Shell, Chevron, Texaco, and the likes of them. And, most especially, those working with the embassies. But coming here, even as a socialist, well, I knew, the workers are going to be different, but I must say that I've been, very, very pleased, with what I've met here. This will be my eighth city, that I've visited in the state. And more or less, the response has been the same. Very warm, always willing to assist, wherever, they could. This is something I intend to take back home so that, as I am sure the people of colonial world will have cause to fight America's imperialism, to fight British imperialism, to fight imperialism all over the world, I think it will be very positive for them to always distinguish between the American workers and youth you know, and the representatives of imperialism. This is the only way I believe positive struggle for change can be effected. Otherwise, we might get trapped into lumping all Americans together. That's what I believe the terrorists that attacked on 9/11 year 2001, you know, did. They didn't make a distinction between the ordinary Americans and the imperialist, you know, forces. Of course, it can be said that the imperialists don't make distinction when they attack the people in the colonial world. But as the English people normally say, two wrongs don't make a right. The second positive impression I've gathered here is, you know, somewhat different. And it has to do with the development, the infrastructural development of this country itself. I'm talking in terms of the road networks, the communications, transportation network, the electricity, you know, telephone system, and all what you have. Of course, I've been to a number of European countries in the past, and I knew what to expect. But, you know, looking at America, a continent-like country, I was not actually expecting, you know, what I've seen here. All the states and cities I've visited, you know, are covered with, you know, well-paved roads. I mean, this is something that is stupendous. It's wonderful. Because I come from a country that is big, you know, by African standard. And when you look at the poor state of infrastructural development, you tend to believe maybe the size of the country is too much. That's why we cannot make progress. I've been able to see here that the size of a country has nothing to do with ability to make progress or not. So if you are not making progress, we should be able to, you know, isolate the reasons why progress is not being made. Of course, when I talk of, you know, the stability of electricity, telecommunication here, there are things you take for granted, at least in one sense. But in Nigeria and many third world countries, this is like, this is something else entirely. When you go home in Nigeria from work, you pray that, God, let there be light. Let me find water. You know, let there be transport. I mean, this is not the same thing here. This is something positive. And I intend to take it back home that, look, a better world is possible. We only have to find what is wrong, what are the causes of our own especial backwardness, and what has, you know, to be done to fight that. I think I should just move on briefly, you know, to the topic of the day, which is the struggle against poverty and neocolonialism in Africa. Well, there's one advantage which people of this part of the world, you know, have. That is, they have access, you know, to a number of informations on the internet, on televisions, on radio, in the newspapers. So I should presume that the question of poverty of Africa, the third world country, is something that many of us are quite familiar with. But since the key aspect of my speech is the struggle against poverty, I think it will still be worthwhile, you know, to give an examples, concrete examples of this poverty situation so that we can understand, you know, how to tackle them. It's like wanting a medical treatment. You have to, you know, start from the diagnosis. Otherwise, you may not apply the correct medicine. Now, according to the United Nations Development Program report, which was released on July 27, 2002, the poorest countries, the 27 poorest countries of the world are all Africans. I mean, there is a league of the richest to the poorest, and the entire lowest 27 are all African countries. No any other country from any other continent, you know, come in between the last, you know, 27 poorest countries in Africa. Of the 35 countries classified in the low human development category, 28 are from Africa. Africa accounts for half of world refugees, while a substantial percentage of people who live with HIV, AIDS, are all from the continent. 85% or 225 million out of 300 million cases of malaria worldwide every year are in Africa. Africa is said today to be owing over $1 trillion to various foreign banks, IMF, and World Bank. I mean, I said said, because it is really tragic that Africa is said to be owing the world, particularly the developed world. One, most of these debts were contracted with military dictators, irresponsible governments that had no mandate, no democratic mandate of their own people. Most of these loans were never used for the actual purposes for which they were contracted. But today, the African people are left to carry the burden, you know, of these debts. And again, I said that it's tragic that Africa is said to be owing this $1 trillion. Because when you study the history of Africa, if anybody is to make claims of debt, I think Africa is the one that should make claims of from the advanced capitalist country of being for indemnity. Because if you study the history of Africa from direct slavery to direct colonialism and to the current strangulating neocolonial arrangement, wherein out of every $1 invested, 20 are taken back. Africa, in reality, does not owe the world. On the contrary, it is the advanced, you know, capitalist world that is owing Africa. Nonetheless, Africa uses, every country of Africa today, uses at least between one-third to half of our annual GDP to service this fictitious debt. And that tells you, I mean, so that when you're talking of poverty, you know why Africa remains trapped in poverty. If a country has to spend annually between one-third and 50% of our total, gross domestic product on servicing debt, then what is left, you know, for positive production? And this is how it works. Between 1984 and 1999, the poorest countries of Africa handed over $11 billion in debt service to Western creditors. Africa today still holds more than three times our original loans. In case you get dizzy or confused about that, I just give you this figure from Nigeria. Nigeria originally borrowed $12 billion from Paris Club, repaid a sum of $17 billion, but still indebted to the tune of $25 billion to the same Paris Club. I mean, it's the usual crooked mathematical manipulations of banks when they work their interests, you know, on debt. You can borrow $100 this year. If you fail to repay it as and when stipulated, the money can suddenly jump to $1,000 without an additional capital. And this is what has been happening. They don't even encourage the continent, you know, to pay the so-called debt, but usually to service the debt so that they remain perpetually in a state of poverty. And now, this is what I've given generally applies to Africa in general. But it will be worthwhile to examine, you know, the negative impact, you know, of this poverty situation in the continent on a few of the countries. And today I'm going to illustrate, you know, the situation in Africa by making copious reference to the situation in Nigeria. Of course, I intend to make some passing references, you know, to other countries in the continent. The fact I intend to relay now are to be found from the Human Development Report, a United Nations organ, which was released in August 2002. And so these are some of the heart-rendering figures or features of poverty as released by United Nations itself. It says, and I quote, "Malnutrition is widespread in Nigeria, although daily per capita supplies of calories is above 2,100. But like all other averages, it hides more than it reveals in terms of household food security. 70% of severe and moderate underweight under 5 infant mortality rate is a sad reflection of the acute state of food insecurity." It goes further to say, "The poverty situation has become worse. The estimate of the 1998 National Human Development Report that 48.5% of the country's population were living below poverty level has now been revised upward to 70%, with all the different dimensions of poverty and deprivation having become aggravated. It says, there is a growing threat to the bare physical survival of the people. Apart from water, food is the most basic input for human survival. In addition, human deprivation, income, poverty, and social deprivation have become aggravated. According to United Nations, 70% of Nigerians now live below poverty level. And by United Nations standard, anyone that lives above $1 per day does not fall into that category. So that means over 70% of Nigerians are living on just below $1 per day. I'm sure for anyone from the developed world, it will be unthinkable, but that tells you the kind of nightmare existence of most people in Africa aside the present period in time. Now, it says, the report says in another aspect that the Nigerian universities are producing relatively too many graduates of dubious quality and relevance. Like I've said elsewhere, this is an understatement, because when you hear this kind of thing, you may have the feeling that, well, majority of people don't get quality education, but some do. There's virtually nobody that gets quality education in Nigeria as of today. The educational systems are virtually collapsed. Name it, from inadequate lecture theaters, non-availability of teaching materials, books, facilities, down to poor payments of teaching staff. As a matter of fact, education at tertiary level has been seriously affected by what is euphemistically called brain drain. And that is a situation where anybody that can find something better to do leaves the country, and teaching only left for those who don't have an alternative. The take-home pay of most academic staff members cannot literally take them home, and that explains why many of them have to leave the country. It's common to find about 1,000 students trying to receive lecture in a lecture theater that was built for 100-250 students originally. If you have a lecture in Nigeria by 9 a.m. and you want a seat, you have to get there by 6 a.m. because very often you may have to stay for 3-4 hours in the same room receiving different lectures. So you have a choice of either going 3 hours before the lecture to secure a seat, or risk standing, for 3-4 hours. Of course, it's not surprising that no meaningful, lecture can be given in that kind of situation. I've been to a number of colleges here. I'm amazed at the wonders of technology. I was in one university in Michigan. In the student union building alone, they have over 200 computers, and you can just walk in, make use of them without anybody asking you where you come from. Back home in Nigeria, so-called faculties of computer sciences hardly at any point in time can boast of 10 functional computers, and that does not include email or internet facilities, because mostly there will be no telephone even to run that where it is possible. So that just gives you a glimpse of what happened at the tertiary level. And at the primary high school level, the conditions are even worse. In Nigeria right now, it's only those that are completely hopeless financially that will allow their children to go to the so-called public primary schools. It has factually collapsed. Sometimes they don't pay the teachers upward of 9-10 months. And where the teachers bother to go to school at all, they don't bother to teach the pupils. So the working class parents are compelled to patronize one so-called private school or the other that have little or nothing to offer. But at least you have the psychological satisfaction that somebody is going to take care of the pupils while they are there. And the high school is no worse. The poor payment of the teachers, inadequate facilities, are the norm in all these places. In fact, in many high schools, particularly in cities, it's usual for children to learn under the trees and what you have. And the health sectors does not fare better. In fact, in the 80s, in 83 precisely, when the military staged one of their usual coups, what they said then, among other reasons, was that they are staging this coup because the health situation in the country has become so bad that the hospitals have become mere consulting clinics. Today, they have graduated from mere consulting clinics to just mortuaries, and sometimes, stinking mortuaries, because there are usually no light even to preserve the dead bodies, whenever this occurs. It is not accidental, again, this background, that the United Nations says 38.8 percent of Nigerians are not expected to live beyond the age of 40 years. I mean, when you take into account all these varieties of poverty, it's even a miracle how people can live up to 40 years in Nigeria. And let me tell you, when we're talking of poverty, the United Nations' own indices are just what you can call a tip of the iceberg. There are several other aspects of poverty, you know, that can make people to have uncomfortable life. But before I go further, I just like to state that why generally poverty is a pervasive situation, phenomenon in Africa, in Nigeria. I like to highlight specially the poverty situation in the Niger Delta region. Niger Delta region is the oil producing sector of Nigeria. And to those who may not know, Nigeria relies almost totally on crude oil exportation for all its revenue. 80% of total revenues and 90% of government revenue, you know, is derived from exportation of crude oil. Oil exploration in commercial quantity started in Nigeria in 1953. Between that time and now, over $350 billion is said to have been extracted, worth of oil is said to have been extracted from the Niger Delta. But what is given back in Niger Delta? Little or nothing, beyond complete devastation and pollution of the environment. I give you an example of what is happening in one of the states in the Niger Delta, in the state where commercial oil exploration actually started. The state is called Bayelsa State. In Bayelsa State, this is what the governor said, and I'm quoting this from a newspaper called The Vanguard of September 9, year 2002. He says, and I quote, three quarters of Bayelsa State is water. We have fresh water, blackish water, and salt water. Yet to get drinkable water, you would have to spend so much money. You have to generate your own electricity with the aid of a turbine. Bayelsa State is the only state not connected to the national electricity grid. And it says further, there is mass unemployment because there are no industries in the state. But who is going to site an industry in a place where there is no light, where accessibility to products is expensive? And it says further, because of the decay in the school system, most of our youth do not have the minimum 5 credits in the ordinary level exams to qualify them for colleges. Most of them are school dropouts. I discovered that little girls of 13, 14 years of age were making babies in the villages. It is pathetic. They can't even look after the babies because they themselves are babies. This is happening in the oil-producing region where billions worth of oil are being extracted annually. But in their insensitivity, the global capitalist corporations that dominate the oil exploration in Nigeria, Chevron, Texaco, Shell, Total, BP, AGIP, and all the rest, they all, without a single exception, cited their corporate headquarters in a city of Lagos, which is over 1,500 kilometers to the region where oil is being produced. Of course, the natural implication of that is that they are never in a position to even witness, you know, the deprivation, the excruciating poverty which most of the people of the oil-producing areas, you know, are forced to live under. You have to take this against the background that most, because of the concentration of oil underneath the soil of Niger Delta, the oil exploration activities have polluted the water, despoiled the soil that is not used, it's not possible to carry out useful agricultural enterprise. Head or tail, the masses of the oil Niger Delta are losers. No jobs, no hospitals, no schools, no roads. And these insensitive global capitalist corporations don't see that anything is wrong with this. When they are confronted with mass protests, you know, by people of the Niger Delta area, or the youth become restive, that they kidnap some important oil officials to extract money, the strategy they have come up with is not, you know, to carry out positive development of the area, to calm frayed nerves, but rather to shift the emphasis of oil exploitation from what they call onshore to offshore. Now they are putting the rigs in deep sea beyond the reach of ordinary people, so that even if the people lie, they can go to places, they can protest from now till eternity. The oil rigs are placed in deep sea far beyond their control, and they are rich. And I think they also calculated that if situation gets too uncomfortable in Nigeria, they can simply bring the warships, you know, to continue, you know, oil exploitation without anybody being able to, you know, touch them. Another aspect of the poverty in Africa, in Nigeria, that is not often encountered in the United Nations report can be glimpsed from these two examples. Last week, there was a boat disaster in Senegal, resulting in the death of over 1,300 people in just one boat mishap. And according to officials, this is what they said, the officials. Officials now say, I accessed this on the internet, you know, day before yesterday. Officials now say 1,034 people, nearly double the boat's official capacity, were on the overcrowded state ferry when it overturned in bad weather. This is a concrete manifestation of absolute poverty. Because why should a boat that is supposed to carry less than 500 people in the first instance carry 1,034 people? And that is what happens factually with all means of transportation in Africa. Cars, buses, trains, people even in Lagos City, for instance, people sometimes, they go on the deck of the train, you know. And so when an accident occurs, you know, this is the kind of thing you get. And hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people die as a result of this in Africa every year. You can't get that in any United Nations data. Another manifestation of this poverty can be glimpsed from this report also. This is from This Day, a Nigerian newspaper of September 30th. It says, 20 people fear killed in a blazing fire from a burst petroleum product in Akute, in a place in Ogun State. Eyewitness accounts informed that scores of villagers had converged at the spot known as Akute Odo to scoop petrol from the burst pipeline. You know, in Nigeria, the pipelines are laid so close to the surface, and they are so whole that it periodically bursts open. And because of the excruciating poverty, whenever it happens, people go there to scoop petrol, which they can sell for money, and periodically, thousands of people, you know, get killed. In 1998, for instance, thousands in a village called Jesse in Delta State were killed in the same process. In November 2000, over 60 people were killed in the same process in an area called Twaka Bay in Lagos State. Like I said, most of the points I've made apply, you know, to many other African countries. In fact, in other African countries, the situation are even worse. Because when you look at several other factors, Nigeria is even, better placed economically in terms of even little development when you compare it with other African states. But meanwhile, the most developed economy in Africa, that is South Africa. The United Nations report on human development released in August this year says that 70% of South Africans live on between $33 to $35 per month. And that tells you the excruciating degree of poverty, not per day, per month. That's just barely over $1 per day. And yet South Africa is the most developed economy in the entire continent. Another frightening figure can be seen from this. This is on Kenya. It says, and I quote, "Poverty has increased, and income inequality and social indicators show worrisome trends. In 2001, the number of Kenyans living below poverty line increased to an estimated 15 million. More than three-quarters of rural and urban poor cannot afford private health care and so depend on public health facilities. Yet, nearly three-fifths of the poor do not even seek public health care because drugs are unavailable. Education indicators are also weak for the poor. 13% of urban poor and 29% of the rural poor have never attended school, and education's high cost is cited as the main reason. You can multiply, hard, or do whatever the figures and features of poverty have cited in the few countries I've made reference to, and you get the same picture in all other African countries. And I think so, therefore, I would like to move on by posing starkly, bluntly, what are responsible, for this state of unmitigated poverty. Because according to various figures, Africa as a continent is stupendously rich. It can produce enough populations to sustain 10 times the current population of Africa. Yet, overwhelming majority of people of Africa today languish in endless poverty. I must say that the basic causes of poverty in Africa and several other third world countries are to be located in the unjust economic system which were imposed on the country at independence. This system is called capitalism. On top of this system, particularly in the past one decade and a half, a more ruthless, manifestation of this system has been introduced in the policy usually generally called neoliberal policies. I say capitalism is the cause in the sense that capitalism is a system that promotes individual... It's too fast. Capitalism is a system that encourages a situation where an individual can own billions while millions have nothing. So right from the beginning, that kind of system is loaded with inherent insoluble problem and contradiction. And in the past 15 years, the problem of capitalism has even been further compounded by the implementation of the most ruthless capitalist policies. These policies are codified under the so-called globalization concept. And the most key aspect of this globalization policies are what they call deregulation, wherein every country should dismantle all form of regulations, trade restrictions. Everybody should be able to buy and sell everywhere. But the problem with this is that for countries of Africa and other third world countries, they are never in a position, to fairly take advantage of this so-called deregulation philosophy. Take Nigeria as an example. If you want to site an industry in Nigeria, you have to generate your own water, you have to generate your own electricity, you have to organize your own transportation, you have to organize your own telecommunications. At the end of the day, the cost of the goods are so high that it cannot be sold locally because of the mass poverty, and they cannot compete effectively internationally, because of cheaper goods or better qualities that have been produced in an environment that is more stable. So far from helping Africa and Nigeria in particular, these policies, tend to worsen the plight and the conditions of the people. For anyone that has been following the last Washington World Bank IMF meeting, there were even protests by some African leaders against the subsidy of agriculture in the U.S. Because what often happens is that even the areas where these poor countries could have an advantage in the area of direct primary products like cotton, textile, and the rest of them, they are at a disadvantage because the U.S. government keeps subsidizing, agriculture here. Whereas they preach the exact opposite of the same philosophy, to the rest of the world. Government is supposed to reduce expenditure on social services, education, healthcare, telecommunications. They must withdraw subsidies from agriculture, from petroleum products, and all the rest. And they practice the exact opposite here in this country. So that is why I feel that if you are talking of solving the problem of Africa on a fundamental basis today, we have to be thinking of a new socio-economic order. The question might be posed that, After all, countries like US, Britain, France developed on the basis of capitalism. Why is it not possible for countries of Africa, you know, and the rest, you know, to be able to develop on the basis of capitalism? I must say that the very logic that made it possible for these countries to develop is the same logic that denies development to the countries of Africa. As one revolutionary, Leon Trotsky, put it, the latecomers into capitalist world, they cannot repeat the same experience and experiment, you know, which made it possible for the older generation of capitalist countries, you know, to grow. Now, if you wonder what does that mean, it simply means that there is no longer colonies that these developing countries can go and colonize. In other words, the countries of Great Britain, France, Germany, US, they made lots of their own wealth and development from the ruthless exploitation of the resources and people of the colonial world. You are familiar with the history of slave trade, which went on for almost 300 years. The most able-bodied, the studied, the strongest, you know, were carted, you know, from Africa to develop the agriculture in the U.S. and Europe as a whole. When they finished with that, they went to direct colonialism, wherein the crudest form of exploitation of the raw materials and natural resources of Africa and other third countries were being done, and while they were turned and remained, you know, a dumping ground for the goods manufacturers in the advanced capitalist world. And the same vicious circle remains up to today. So there is no way by which the countries of Africa can develop within the framework of capitalism. The simple reason being that Nigeria, for instance, is rich in steel. But if you want the steel sector to be developed in Nigeria, the America's businessmen will be fearing a competition with the steel produced in America, in Japan, and the fear that the prices will become low in the market. Because capitalism is a system that is geared towards profit and prestige, not, you know, the needs of the masses. It's profit that is always constant. They don't go into production to say, let's produce cars to make everybody happy. Let's produce telephone to make everybody happy. They produce, you know, to maintain certain level of profit. And when they have acquired too much than they can do with it, they declare the market as having been glutted. In Nigeria, for the past one decade, there's no time when capacity utilization has exceeded 30%. And this is a country that is ravaged by mass poverty. So the question is, why can they not produce up to the fullest of capacity? You see that they have fed every hungry mouth, they have clothed every naked, you know, body, they have given education to every illiterate, they have treated every sick person. That is not the case. But capitalism is not interested in that. It's only interested in profit. And that's why we are demanding for a new socioeconomic order, wherein the needs of the masses, the basic needs of everybody in society, will be the yardstick of production. And this can only be possible under a socialist planned economy, where the commanding heights of the economy are placed under public ownership and planned so that production is for use and not, you know, for profit. Now, I just like to say, because some people may get the feelings that, well, maybe that applies to Nigeria, but that countries like US don't need that kind of thing. I disagree. From the little experience I've been able to gather here, I realize that while there is light, stable light, telephone, roads, decent accommodations, I realize that majority of the working class people have to spend virtually their lifetime just barely struggling, you know, to make ends meet over these things. I mean, and this is not supposed to be the case. I read something in yesterday's Financial Times, and it says that it's a wonder that one quarter of the world is in absolute poverty of the world population. And it says another aspect of the wonder is that the world has sufficient technological and human resources that can abolish poverty in the world. This is the contradiction of capitalism. And this still exists even in the most developed, the richest of the world nations, and that is the United States. It would be nice to have to ponder over some of these points. For instance, Business Week of April 30, 2001 says, and I quote, "Homeowners are now loaded up with debts are loaded up with debt during the 90s through second mortgages, etc., to a record level of $5.4 trillion. So that means majority of homeowners that have people that have decent homes today, many of them are able to live in that decent accommodation because they are living on borrowed time. Many of them are on their second mortgages. That does not strike me as a manifestation of a country that is completely healthy economically. Another aspect of that says that this another factor which gives the worrisome nature of the U.S. society itself says that the growth in GDP in the last period, that is 1990-1999, was only 2.6%, whereas during the post-war boom, the growth rate between 1948 and 1953, for instance, was 5.4. Between 1960 and 69 was 4.3, while between 1980 and 1990 was only 2.8. That means even the growth rate is systematically declining. If when the situation is like this, majority of homeowners or a good number of homeowners on their second mortgages, if this thing goes down, then you can imagine, you know, what, you know, will happen, you know, at the end of the day. Then it says in another aspect that you can get all this also from Business Week of May 7, 2001. It says the collapse in manufacturing industry is reflected in the growing trade deficit. A comparison of the dollar value of goods the U.S. export to other countries compared to how much it imports. The trade deficit with developing nations alone was $170 billion in year 2000. And in another areas, it says that Business Week of the same 5-7 says that by the end of year 2000, the U.S. current account deficit was more than four times larger than it was at the end of 1995 and had grown to a record 4.6% of GDP. These are manifestations of organic disease, you know, afflicting the U.S. economy and society itself. Another major worrisome data of capitalism as concerns the U.S. is this. It says, and I quote, that the wealthiest 1% of households now controls 40% of total wealth. The bottom 40% of households control only 0.2%. So that even in this wonderland, you can now see the reason why majority of people can only barely struggle to survive on the basic, you know, essentials of life, because just 1% of the populace control between themselves 40% of wealth. And that should not be a surprise if one individual in the name of Mr. Bill Gates can have over $100 billion dollars. Then what do you expect? So by the time they multiply people like Bill Gates and the rest, they constitute about 1% of the population, but they control over 40% of the total wealth of the household, you know, wealth. Another worrisome aspect of the U.S. society, which you give any serious thinking person, you know, food for thought, is to be found in the regimentation of not only social inequality, but racial inequality. In 1992, 92.6% of those convicted for crimes involving crack cocaine were African-American, and 4.7% were white. However, a U.S. Sentencing Commission survey found that 65% of all crack users were white. The racist drug laws are also behind the majority of cases of harassment of youth and the policies of racial profiling. These are dynamite, and these are unnecessary. The world, as at the moment, has enough sufficient technological prowess, human resources and technique that can banish poverty, hunger, discrimination from the surface of earth. But as long as capitalism as a system remains internationally, it will be a war of problems, world of wars. If it is not against Iraq, it will be against North Korea. Maybe it will go back to Pakistan, who is the friend and darling of the U.S. imperialism today, just as Iraq itself was the client of imperialism, you know, 8 years earlier. In order to round up, I'd like to pose the question, can, is change possible? I mean, given the myriad of problems which I've enumerated, given the stranglehold of imperialism on the world's economic situations, particularly those of the third world countries, I must say that change is possible. It's possible to have a better world, a world free of religious and ethnic strifes, as we have in Africa today. In Nigeria, in the past 4 years, in the past 3 years alone, over 20,000 people have been killed as a result of one ethnic or religious strife. Not to talk of millions that have been displaced. So, the reason, as I've enumerated before, is caused by poverty. And I want to believe that a better world is possible. I will use Nigeria as an example. On virtually all occasions in the recent period, in contemporary times, Nigerians can never be found united around any topic whatsoever, with the exception of one subject, soccer. When the Nigerian national team is playing soccer, then that is the only time you can see Nigerians exhibiting complete, undivided patriotism. Everybody wants the Super Eagles to win. As soon as the football match, as we call it in Nigeria, is over, it's to your tents, O Israel, everybody to himself or herself. Now, the only other exception, which I think is more fundamental, is when the working class, you know, come up with concrete agenda. In the past 3 years, the Nigerian Labour Congress, the Trade Union Federation Organization, has organized two successful general strikes around a protest against increases in the prices of petroleum products. What happened in year 2000 and year 2002 was that the government increases the prices of petroleum products, diesel, petrol, gas, kerosene. And most people cannot see why this has to be the case. Nigeria is the sixth largest oil exporting country in the OPEC community. But government keeps on saying that it subsidizes, the petroleum product. So, which of course does not go down well with people, that why can you say that you subsidize things that is, produced, extracted from Nigeria's soil, a gift of nature? Then, again, there is the other worrisome aspect. Whenever the prices of petroleum products are increased, the prices of all other things, goods and services, automatically, will go up. It's standard because there is no stable electricity, there is no functional roads. So every time the prices go up, the transporters will increase their fares. Companies will increase the prices of their goods because most of them are run on separate generators with, the tons of diesel oil and the rest like that. So this is usually a touchy issue. The Nigerian Labour Congress therefore organized strikes on the two occasions. And these strikes were absolutely and marvelously supported by the working masses across the country. This shows that change is possible. The question is to identify the correct social forces that is capable of effecting this change and working towards its victory. But I must say, however, that while the labor movement has shown the potential to unite Nigeria, which is not a mean achievement, because this is a country that most of the time is divided along ethnic, religious, and whatever. Even within the same nationality, people disagree from one local government or borough to the other. But remarkably, whenever the labor movement comes up with any concrete issue, either in defense of minimum wage or against increments of petroleum products, it always received marvelous support. This shows that it is possible to unite the people of Nigeria. It is possible to keep Nigeria as a corporate entity. But that can only be done if the labor movement itself has correct ideological and strategies, to change society. Unfortunately, the labor movement does not seem to have that now. And that is because all their strategies, all their struggles are placed within the framework of making capitalism to work. The struggle for minimum wage, not just to better the conditions of today by linking that struggle with overall change of the system, but with an utopian perspective that workers can be made to get sufficient minimum wage within the framework of capitalism. And what often happens is that once minimum wages are increased, prices of goods and services are increased because these are variables that are not under the control of the working class. Again, while they have been constantly struggling against the deregulation of the oil sector, the labor leaders themselves say they support the deregulation, privatization of the electricity board, telecommunications, and all other key sectors of the economy. This is a contradiction. As I pointed out, all these entities, when they are privatized, contrary to the preachment of World Bank and IMF, they do not necessarily mean better services. Even where they mean better services, it usually means better services for a much more reduced section of the population and leaving the majority in the state of absolute poverty. This is no progress. What Africa and many other countries need is massive expansions of road constructions, schools, hospitals, jobs, not the opposite. What the IMF and World Bank advocate is the exact opposite of what is actually needed. Reduction of social services, reduction of healthcare, spending, education. And when these things happen, the purchasing power of the country becomes so low that even the industrial development becomes impossible. And that's why when you go to Nigeria today, most of the multinational corporations that were in manufacturing industry before, they are packed up business. And all they do, where they remain, is just to import goods that were produced from their sisters, corporations and things like that. Then, to change the society too, it's possible to change society if we have the correct orientation, therefore. And one of the basic things that people of Africa, the world, need to fight for is the development of a mass revolutionary party of the workers, youth, peasants in the colonial world. In the advanced capitalist world, a mass revolutionary workers' party. Look at the U.S. I've been following the debate on the Iraq war since I came here, and I tend to be confused between the positions of the Republicans and the Democrats. In most cases, I can hardly make any distinction. This is worrisome. Because sometimes when you read the Democrats, what they just say is not so much a condemnation of the fundamental strategies of the Republicans, but that they say, well, maybe you should have put it this way. I can't see any positive way forward, for the workers and youth in the U.S. as long as these two main parties dominate the setting. It's the same thing that we are confronted with in Africa. In Nigeria today, there are six political parties. And when I say six political parties, these are legalized, authorized parties. In Nigeria, you cannot just run any political party of your choice, even though the constitution says so. But those in powers have always ensured they sabotage that. When the chairperson introduced me the other time as the chairperson of the National Conscience Party, which he describes as the main opposition party in Lagos, I think I must give an explanation. It's the main opposition in the sense that it is the only party that is opposed to the anti-poor, pro-rich manifestos of the other political parties. Apart from that, it is not regarded as a political party by Nigerian context because it has not been given the permission to field candidates. Whereas all the rest political parties, they subscribe to the same negative neoliberal policies of privatization, of deregulation, of mass poverty. And only the NCP, for instance, is opposed to mass retrenchment as a solution to problems. The NCP says that you have to give job to everybody. Everybody must be educated. When you educate people, you are not doing them favor. Because it is the level of educational quality and development of citizens that determine the overall development of societies. But imperialists and capitalists all over the world, they regard education as a privilege that should only be given, to those that are rich. Now, I said, and I still maintain, change is possible. And this is on the point I'm going to round up. In 1993, during the military era, they did what they call the transition program. We are in it's a program of disengagement, but they call it a democratization program, but it's the exact opposite of the word democracy, because they formed the political parties themselves, built offices for them, wrote their manifestos and constitution, appointed their leaders. At the end of the day, election was held. They were not satisfied. They still wanted to remain in power. They annulled the election. our organization in Nigeria, the Democratic Socialist Movement, we are called Labour Militant then. We were working in a pro-democracy movement, just like you have anti-war coalition here. And we went into that movement, which was a movement of very few pro-democracy individuals, middle-class elements, and ourselves, who are very numerically small. And we went into that body and demanded that let us have a protest. The leadership wanted what they call Democracy Night Fiji, where people would light candles and just move around in the street at night as if it were money. And we demanded that, no, don't let us do that. Let's carry out an open protest, even if it is 50, if it is 100 people. And I must tell you what happened later, dramatically changed the face, the political landscape of Nigeria. Ultimately, the leadership accepted to carry out a protest. The following day, in the city alone, in Lagos City alone, over 350,000 people were on the street of Lagos demonstrating, with millions standing in front of their homes in support of the struggle. And that was the pattern in many other cities. And that dramatically changed the landscape. And it's the same thing I advise and advocate here now. The reactionary government of Bush and their twin brothers in the Democrats, they will not mind to plunge the world into war. They will not mind to go and wage war against innocent, defenseless people of Iraq, if not checkmated. And a lot can be done by our own little activities. And that, in fact, convinced me that if we fight, we can win, whereas if we don't, we may lose. The problem, however, is this. People have asked me several times, and I think I must just address this, that, against the picture I painted, do I think that the struggle for change will be very easy? Never. The struggle for change will never be easy, and it has never been easy for us. Many activists have been killed in Nigeria. Many are retrenched from their jobs. For instance, in Lagos State, our own comrade, who is a member of the organization, was at the same time the chairman of the Public Sectors Workers Union. In the year 2000, the Labour Federation negotiated a new minimum wage with the federal government. When they approached their state governor and government for the implementation, the government refused to carry out this implementation. And the workers, under the leadership of our comrades, were forced to organize a strike, a public strike which lasted for 21 days. At the end of the strike, the government was forced to agree to pay some percentage of increment, not even the total increment which they were demanding for. Because the government says that if you have to pay this total increment, we have to retrench workers. So the workers decided to sign an agreement on what the government said it was going to pay. A week after the government signed that agreement, it rolled out retrenchment letters. In the process, about 15,000 workers were laid off, with a special emphasis on those who played the most prominent role during the struggles, for the implementation of minimum wage. As a result of that now, scores of our comrades have been retrenched. They have not served a number of years they are expected to serve in public service. They did not commit any crime. They did not violate the civil service rule, but they have all been sacked. All the government just did was to look at the videotapes of those that were most focused at the protest, and they were all sacked. Routinely, students in colleges are expelled from colleges for the simple crime that they are fighting, for better conditions. These are the kind of problems and the challenges that activists and people, revolutionaries like myself, that are struggling for change in Africa, in Nigeria, are confronted with. But we have come to a conclusion that there is no alternative for us. Every other alternative is more destructive, more expensive, and less rewarding. Those that are not in the kind of frame of mind as ourselves to struggle for better life are either engaged in one form of negative activities, crime, prostitution, drug pushing. And all these have been seen to even be much more negative, for the working masses overall. So we have resolved, that what we will continue to do is to struggle, for a mass change, through a workers' and peasants' socialist revolution. I thank you for listening to me. And as a result, in order to encourage us in this struggle, I appeal to you to generously donate whatever you are capable of donating to us in order to sustain, the struggle against all odds which we are waging in Nigeria, in Africa as a whole. Thank you very much.